Hello and welcome back to the Rope Access and Climbing Podcast. I'm your host, Mikey Stevenson, and today I'm going to be talking to Craig from the Cracker Jack Group. If this is your first time here, please make sure to subscribe and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. So stay tuned. Step into your harness and get ready for a podcast about the vertical world. All right, well, let's dive into today's episode with Craig. Welcome, Craig. Can you kind of give us a little bit of an introduction of, you know, who you are, where you come from, and what you do?
Sure. You just did the easy part. You did Craig. So last name's McClure. I own the Cracker Jack Group, which is a technical rescue and consulting service. We're based in now, we're in Mancos, Colorado, which is Southwest Colorado, just outside Durango. Doesn't really matter where we are. As you know, in this world, most of your time is spent on an airplane going somewhere else. So we came here just for lifestyle and the opportunity to build out a training center, which we're working on, and to hopefully cut down on some of that travel and make this a better lifestyle. So I train rescuers and rescue teams, not necessarily on a set curriculum. We're not a training factory. We don't issue certification. We may fall under the ITRA scheme someday. Somehow we'll see how that plays out. As we say, and that was actually given to me by a client last year, our goal is just to make the best better. My question when we go in and train someone isn't necessarily what do you want to learn, but I like to ask the question, what do you want to be better? Like, how do you want your team better for the investment you've made in us and in time and money and resource? Where do you want your improvement to show up? So I love it.
Nice.
It's a great life. It's hard. As you know, it's hard work. It's a lot of time away. There's not a lot of certainty in this industry. But I get to do something I love and generally work with people I really enjoy.
Nice. Well, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you here on the podcast today. And so today we will be chatting about dilemmas. Today we'll be chatting about the internal dilemma as an instructor, kind of the internal dilemma of the industry, operating under a lightweight system of mountain rescue and rescue systems, and the push of redundancy from the large industry, i.e. IRATA and SPRAT, on the small industry of mountain rescue. So let's dive into our first kind of conversation here. We're going to be talking about the internal dilemma. So you teach all different types of courses. You've been involved with large industry, small industry courses, and kind of seen your fair share of, you know, rope systems. Now, as instructors, we struggle with this internal dilemma of teaching the course we want to teach opposed to the course we need to teach. This is just a common thing that we have as a new instructor. Obviously, you grow out of it, you get better at it, and kind of understand your clientele a little bit better, understand the syllabus a little bit better. But how do you deal with this yourself?
I think it's the magic. I think it's the magic in being a good instructor is building some trust off the bat. And I think that starts kind of and to put it in a sales term, like the qualification phase of dealing with a client. It's trying to figure out what they really need and making sure you deliver that. I don't think anyone will see themselves in the statement, but it might give you a chuckle. You know, the team that calls and says, hey, we need a bunch of really advanced training. Like in the back of your mind, you're like, all right, so we'll start day one with knots. A lot of times until you can do either a remote or kind of an in-person quick survey of skills, you don't really know what they need. And in this world, the skills ladder, right? You've got to have basics, to even get to fundamentals, and you've got to have strong fundamentals before you can start to put those together into more complex solutions and more complex problems. So I think the real magic is being able to kind of quickly adjust their expectations. And what I found is if you're one honest about it and say, look, I know you brought me here to teach you, you know, in-flight missile repair technology. But right now we got to learn to fly first. And I'm seeing a few things. You give them examples that I think we need to brush up on a few things, tighten up a few things before we can jump to that next step you want to get to. And if you can approach that well, you can pretty easily adjust the expectation. If you show up and you just try to hammer a set curriculum because that's easy and it's what you have documented, and you just go step A, step B, step C, you're going to lose people and you're going to miss the mark. They're not going to get what they really need. And I feel like that's our job, is to make people better at what they're doing, and you have to meet them where they are. So it's less of a dilemma now for me and more almost a kind of a point of pride. Can I make that happen every time?
Yeah. Yeah. And that just comes with time, you know, trial and error, and just trying to figure out, one, who your client is and where they stand.
And if they're not happy with it, I don't think we can fix that. If their ego is so tied up and needing to do something greater than they're ready for, you're not the right trainer for them. And that's okay too. You know, maybe this isn't a long-term marriage and you move on and they find the person that fits them better or sees them in a different light than I see them.
Yeah, absolutely. How do you deal with trainees that don't really want to be there? Now, obviously, in a lot of cases, you have a lot of people that pay out of pocket to be there. They've outsourced you. They've done their research and understood what they're getting themselves into. But you also have people that have been brought to you from an organization, and you know they're buy-in may not be the same as everybody else. How's that for you?
Yeah, so you're right. They're kind of two different types of clients. There are those that are personally invested in being there. Mm-hmm. Whether they pay it out of pocket as a professional, you know, they're a firefighter using their own vacation time and paying out of pocket, or they're a volunteer and that's just pure give. They're easier to deal with, right? They have the motivation, but you can see it when you get to a room, especially like a paid department. You always have the guy in the back who's like leaning back, arms crossed, and he's got this look on his face. It's like, I dare you, teach me something, dude. Try it. And a lot of times those guys they're the elder in the department, or they're the in-house expert. And I key on that person. Like if I find a way to engage them and get them excited and get them learning, everyone's going to follow along. But long ago I had an instructor in another discipline I really liked, and he used to call them the yeah, but what if guy. Yeah, but what if guy is the guy in the back who always is, you know, you're like, okay, so, you know, what is it? You know, force is mass times acceleration. And he'll be like, well, yeah, but what if you're on the moon? And you're like, okay, so I have that guy, right?
The game of what if.
Yeah, he wants to play the game of what if to see it, to see if he can find your cracks.
Yeah.
So I find that guy a challenge. I find that person makes me better because I'm always nervous before a class. I'm always nervous. Am I going to have that guy who can, I know I don't know everything, but is there that person that can kind of wedge into those cracks and break down my credibility and kind of ruin my course? So he's kind of my motivation to keep learning and learning new ways to teach people so I can figure out how to get through to those people. But in the end, if they don't want to be there, you move on, right? And sometimes you got to tell them, or you got to tell their supervisor, you know, hey, that dude over there just doesn't want to engage. Do you want me to engage them? Is it my job here to try to draw them out? Is there something special here? Or do you want me to move on and let them tell and kind of let them lead that?
Yeah. Yeah. When I was in the, you know, private sector of teaching, it was pretty easy for me to deal with that because it was just like, you know, you just tell the supervisor and at the end of the day, you have last say and you kind of already knew a little bit into the course how it was going to play out. But on the private sector, it's a lot more challenging because you do have people paying out of pocket to be there. And, you know, you still do have to have those conversations and let them make that decision. But, yeah, obviously, if they're paying out of pocket, they've done their research. They know what they're getting themselves into 9 times out of 10. I think the physical capabilities still kind of lag on people. They kind of don't really understand the amount of intensity that, you know, these courses put on the body. But, you know, outside of that, like, you know, if someone's paying to be there, they've done the research, you know, that expectation, that want, need to learn is definitely a lot higher than in the private sector for sure.
And we owe it to them. You know, if they're there on their own, if they took a week off of their job or they're burning a week's vacation and they went out of pocket, you know, anywhere from $700 to $1,500 for a week,
yep,
we owe them a good product.
Absolutely. 100%.
You can't go through the motions for that.
No. And for me, it's just like, I tell them right from the get go, your success is my success. So like, if you are not successful, you know, I take that personally and I need to do better. You know, it's an unacceptable kind of time if someone's not successful. However, you know, in the rope access industry specifically, like, you know, there's brain farts, things happen, you know, little slip ups, and that third party evaluator or assessor is there to ensure that you can be safe. You know, you can't necessarily blame yourself all the time for someone not being successful, but you know, you have to give them the tools and the best opportunity possible to be successful and be safe.
And likely, if you're doing it well, you've prepared them for that possibility of failure, right?
Yeah.
The most skilled person can screw up an assessment on any given day, right? There are no guarantees in it.
And absolutely.
And they've got to understand. And I'll bet you have some stories of your own. You can tell me like, hey, so there I was. Right? I'm pretty good at what I do. And here's the mistake I made.
Oh, 100%. You know, I was doing a demo in a class once and doing a rescue, all level threes. So like people are going like at the top of their game, going for their level three assessment. And here I'm doing a demo and I put the casualty on 1 point. Man, did I not, I wasn't able to live that down for the entire week and just everyone just burst out laughing at me. I'm like, hey, see, I'm human too. I can make mistakes too. You know, obviously you're teaching, you're talking, you've got a lot of things going on, but it's happened.
It's why I don't have screw locks on my harness anymore.
Well, come on, screw locks are the best way to learn.
I had a great assessment going and I missed towards the end. I was getting tired end of the day and I just didn't lock two gates. Right. Yeah. So
yeah,
I want to go backwards a little bit. Cause we talked before and then we shot some notes back and forth. I don't want to kill your process for the world, but this is
no.
Okay.
Absolutely.
We talked about dilemma last time you sent the notes and
yeah,
to me, there's kind of a different dilemma. The first one I think we've solved, right?
Absolutely.
If they don't want to be there, we do our best to engage them. We figure out what their hot buttons are. Sometimes you got to let them shine a little bit to get them to engage. You know, sometimes it's just confidence and ego, whatever it is. We can solve that. But the more challenging one for me is not getting caught in this do as I say, not as I do moment. And to be straight out with it, there are things that I feel obligated because of the industry to teach. Mm-hmm. We'll throw it out there, like this move towards absolute redundancy.
Yeah.
It's a lot easier just to go with that and say, do it. because no one ever got fired for having too much redundancy. Right.
Correct.
You know, they used to say in the public safety world, no one ever got fired for buying Motorola. Like, there are certain decisions you can make that are just unquestionably understood by the industry that mm-hmm. they're just the right decision or they're not the wrong decision. And this like ultimate redundancy is one of them.
Yep.
But as a practitioner, and even as an educator, I don't necessarily agree with it.
And I will personally agree as well with that statement.
I mean, we were doing a lightweight class, and we had just said, look, we're gonna bring out some really scary lightweight gear. But what we're gonna do is we brought ASAPs and 11 mils, and we're just gonna drop second lines and put you on the ASAP. So while you're learning it, you're safe. Right. Mm-hmm. I totally agree with that in an educational environment, right? Let's take yep. away learning error and not let it be catastrophic. But absolutely. But a student said, like, yep. what would you do in the real world? I was like, well, if I knew the equipment and I'm comfortable with the gear and I can mitigate the issues, like, would I go single rope all the time? Right. Can I control my fall line? Can I protect my edges? Do I know how to use my device? Can I mitigate all the
things?
What's
the condition
that would cause a problem?
What's the condition of the equipment?
Pardon?
What's the condition of the equipment? Yeah. Is something that has to go through your head as well. Like, when was it last inspected?
Yeah.
Can you verify its integrity?
Yeah. And if I can control those things and I'm knowledgeable about those things, would I do it? For some situations, yeah, I would.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard as an educator to leave that gray area on the table and say, you can sometimes maybe, and it takes the rare group of students where you can let them navigate that gray area. So I think we mm-hmm. fall towards these bigger absolutes of, well, no, just don't ever do it because it's not safe. And
yeah.
that's the one I struggle with. Cause I think faulting to that absolute, isn't genuine. And I guess isn't real. I guess I can be redundant in my wording.
Yeah.
But I haven't yet figured the way through that. And I think that's what gives me the heartburn.
Yep. You know, as a mountaineer prior to getting into rope access, I understand this dilemma personally as well. And going to be, you know, pursuing to be the mountain guide, you know, you're doing mountain rescue, you're working on, you know, 8-9 millimeter dynamic ropes, using standard prussics and pulleys and stuff like this. And you have all lightweight equipment. But then jumping into the rope access industry where it's large industry and it's redundant this, redundant that, it's two of these, two of those. All the equipment is just extremely heavy and bulky and absurd in some cases.
Yeah. I also,
but being able to, you know, switch that light, take that light switch and turn it on or turn it off. That's something that I personally had to learn. Because I was just like, oh, well, I can do this because I know my capabilities, but then, you know, in the rope access industry, it's really frowned upon because you are that much more comfortable with being, you know, maybe a little bit less redundant. And that goes into that dilemma of acceptable or unacceptable mm-hmm. of like what industry we're operating under. And, you know, we'll dive into the meat and potatoes of that a little bit more later on. But, you know, I can relate. Obviously not in the same industry as you, but as a mountaineer and as a rope access technician, it can shine some light on that as well.
I think there are two other things at play as well. Comparing rope access and rescue is tough, right? Cause rope access is pre-planned, right?
Yep.
You can take all the time you want to do a recce, to write plans. You can go as slow as you need to go generally. Rescue, when you show up, you're already behind the curve and you're trying to catch up to an unstable situation. And I think the other part of that dilemma that maybe I'm just chicken, but I think we need to be honest about is a student's decision isn't worth my house or isn't worth my business or isn't worth my kid's future. Right. So if I leave gray area or I leave and I think someone is borderline going to make an unsafe decision. One, I never want to see someone get hurt, right? I've never had someone get hurt in a class. I've never been on a rescue where there was any significant injury to a rescuer other than someone wrecking a snowmobile and those, well, that happens, or rolling an ATV, but never rope related. But when I leave, what happens? And like, I have to have this conversation with insurance companies because the insurance industry doesn't understand what we do either, right?
Yeah.
If I teach you to do something and you go rescue someone and that person gets hurt, they're going to trace that back to me. Hey, you taught Mikey to rescue people on dental floss and my wife got hurt. It's your fault. Or you taught Mikey to do, you know, to improperly tie a butterfly, which never happens, right?
Never.
And Mikey taught someone else on the team and Mikey believed that he was qualified because you had taught him. And now someone got hurt. And that chain of liability has to factor into your mind. And maybe maybe with me, it does too much. And maybe it's that I come from a family of lawyers. I don't know.
I think you also come, well, you are, you know, you come from a different country where that's a little bit more pronounced than here in Canada.
Oh yeah. We sue people because we fall down on the sidewalk here. Yeah,
exactly. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. You know, like, you know, growing up as a kid, you know, you can't skateboard on this parking lot because, you know, if you fall and get hurt, you're going to sue the company. It's just like, I'm a kid playing around on a skateboard. Yeah. Like, why am I suing a company?
Yeah, we are the reason that every McDonald's cup in the world has a caution coffee is hot label on it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right. Well, you know, is there anything else you need to kind of, or is there anything else you want to chat about the, or, you know, are we kind of?
No, I wish we could have more honest discussions about this part as instructors, and with students. I've joked with a friend of mine, Cliff Freer in New York, about we want to do classes where we can get rid of this gray area by saying, look, here's the deal. We don't endorse a lot of the stuff we're about to do, but we want to try it. We want to experience it with you. We want to make decisions about it. We want you to make decisions about it. And you can't take any pictures. You can't post it on YouTube and you can't tell people about it. Like almost a, I'm out. Almost a Vegas rules class, right?
I'm out.
Like, not be unsafe, but kind of take down the guardrails and let people play in that space safely. We've tried to do that with some of the lightweight stuff.
Try to figure out a way to, you know, teach, you know, real life problem solving and decision making.
Yeah.
Here's a whole lot of gear. Here is the scenario. Figure it out.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We're going to stand back and watch and see how this turns out. If we see anything that is critically unsafe, we'll stop the situation, talk about it.
Yeah. That's kind of where we're headed with that, with this Rescue the Rescuer program. We were sitting around and it was a good idea that came out of a time in Canada, which is a rare statement, so I'm going to say it. Sitting around the office with the Ronin guys, and I said, you know, what really bothers me is we never trained in the negative event, right? We say that we have our systems and they're nearly infallible because we build them this way. Have we ever talked about the kind of the when the stuff hits the fan moment, how are we going to fix it? And what are we going to do? And I think that's what you're talking about, like problem solving outside the bounds of normal.
Yeah. Because you and I, know, and you know, you've encountered countless amount of rescues and I've been involved with my fair share, and no two rescues, even in a training center, even under ideal circumstances, you know, the same rope, the same people, the same environment, like no two rescues are the exact same.
Yeah.
And it's a tool-based learning, not a skill-based learning. And that's what I try to teach people is like, I'm going to give you the tools to be successful. It's your job to be able to pull them out of the tool chest and execute the rescue effectively. You know, because they're like, it dives into that question about, well, what about this or what about this? And, you know, unfortunately, the best answer is it depends.
Yeah.
And that answer just drives people, you know, pulls their fingernails up because they're just like, but I'm like, there's no buts. It depends. Like, I'm going to walk into one building and rig a job up one way. I'm going to walk in the same building from a different door and rig the job completely different. I'm going to do something. I'm going to walk into a mountain, you know, creek one way or rappel in from another way. And my perspective is completely different. So the answer and the only answer that matters, it depends.
Yes. And do you have the equipment, the skills, and in the knowledge to think laterally through those problems?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, is what's the military saying? No plan survives first contact with the enemy. So can you get into a situation and look at it and say, well, plan A isn't going to work, you know, because we have no anchorage, or fall line doesn't work, or ropes aren't long enough. And can you move sideways to solve that problem?
Yeah.
That's the fun stuff.
Absolutely. All right. Excellent. So I think that, that internal dilemma without beating the dead horse, I think, you know, we've covered the two aspects of it of, you know, what it's like to be an instructor and dealing with those sort of dilemmas, and obviously getting through that as an instructor is, it really comes down to education and experience. The internal dilemma of, you know, pressure put on from other industries, and do as I say, not as I do. Those are, you know, at the end of the day, comes down to it depends. It sucks, yeah. But it is what it is. And, you know, it comes down to experience as well. There's no set answer. Like I said, it depends, really answers a lot of it. But without that understanding and knowledge and breakdown of systems and, you know, your clients and the environment, there's no set answer. I believe.
Yeah, I think it depends is important, and maybe I need to be more comfortable saying it to students. Once we pick absolute marks and absolute decision points, we start depleting people's ability to solve problems, because mm-hmm. we've told them you don't even think about this. This is just a rule, and it's the way it is. And unless you can explain why it is the way it is, they're not going to be able to think through it or think past it.
Yeah. I think also to clarify for the people out there and your clients, maybe just because people are having a hard time these days understanding the difference between absolute and gray area. Absolute is a rule. You must adhere to XYZ. A gray area is it depends.
Yeah, I was on a team that solved that gray area in policy by saying we will do X, and it was actually we will use two rope systems, and then we added in the phrase unless it's deemed less safe to do so. And,
yes.
And left that up to the practitioner in the field to make that decision to say today it's actually less safe to do it this way, and we're going to do something different. We left room for that decision. And I'm sure the lawyers hated it.
It depends, man.
Great.
moving on. So you specialize in the lightweight mountain rescue environment. We've talked back and forth about this. And, you know, for me, being a mountaineer, I understand it, but for the people out there that don't understand it, can you explain what does this look like? Give some of the, you know, the gear you use, or kind of explain a little bit and talk about, you know, private sectors and government sectors.
Yeah, so I think I need to start by saying don't necessarily specialize in it. Like I have departments. I have 12-5 equipment here, right? But it kind of leads into the discussion. You need to train people with the right tools for the job they're going to do. And sometimes that means they need different tool sets. Sometimes it means they need one. You know, if you're an urban department responding off the truck all the time, this is kind of an unpopular opinion. Why the heck not just go with big fat 12.5 and stay with it, right? Doesn't matter. Weight doesn't matter.
You may overload the fire truck.
You could. You're right.
Yeah. You know, that 11 mil to 12 and a half mil, it may just put it over the.
And your friends in the task force will laugh at you because exactly. You're still doing it the old way. But for me, the push for lightweight was really kind of how I came into the industry. I started on joining a mountain rescue team. I'd been a search and rescue volunteer for over a decade at the time. I'd actually been a dog handler. I'd done lots of other stuff. I'd written curriculum on search management, but we moved to this new area and it had these awesome mountains. And I just found those are the people I really liked. I liked the people on the mountain rescue team. I liked the rope people. It's who I wanted to be around. It's who I wanted my family to be around. And I started training with them. And our push had to be, what rescues could you solve? How much could you solve with what you carried on your harness on most outings, right? If you're going to skin in for 7 miles to get to a rescue scene, or you're going to ride a snowmobile through deep powder, hop off, get on your skins and start climbing. You got to get there, and you got to get there not so tired that you can still solve the problem. So it really came out of that necessity initially. How much could you do with what you had? And I worked with a friend who used a great term, and it's a big word, so I'm hesitant to use it in the rope world, which he said, you need to solve it with ubiquitous equipment, right? What do you have, and what does everyone always have with them? And
yep.
It's not even worth discussing, is it safe or unsafe, until you've discussed if you're actually solving the problem. Let's build a system that hauls skiers over from below. You know, you're on top, you're behind a cornice, and you've got a skier clipped out 50 feet below you. They can't go down. They have to come up. What equipment can you get to scene and get them up over that edge to safety? And if the only equipment is what two people can carry in their packs and get there in a timely manner, that is the safest solution you have. That solution is not going to be deemed safe if you're pulling a window washer off of a swing platform in a metropolitan area, right? You'd look at that and say, oh my God, that's not worth it. But you can get different equipment to that scene. So that was kind of the initial part of the approach. And that started out as climbing gear, right? That's plaquette devices and Dyneema slings and 8 mil or smaller glacier rope. The fat rope we carried was the 9 mil. So it's about having the right tools and the right solution for the right problem.
I climb around, done a lot of mountaineering stuff with, 30 meters of 8 millimeter rope. You know, that's where I'm short roping up on ridges of mountains and, you know, doing glacier travel. That's what you have. You have 8 millimeter, 30 meters of rope. That's all you have.
If it's too heavy to carry and you're not going to carry it, then it's not worth having, right? If it's not going to be there.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're not willing to throw it in the bottom of your pack every time you go out, then it's the wrong tool.
Like 60 meters of 10 mil rope or 30 meters of 8 mil rope, that's a huge amount of huge amount of weight and size.
And I carry a, what is it, I cut it in half, so I have two 30 meter sections of Dragonfly, and in the parking lot I throw the other half to my partner and say, you carry this half, right? But it has to be small enough that you're willing to take it with you. So that's kind of the continuum, right? This, here's the big and heavy that is big and heavy for a reason and works for a reason. And then there's so light, it's almost frightening. and now experiment with enough different options to find the right middle ground for the solution for the situation you're going to be in. You know, I think for a lot of places that's in the 11 mil realm. You're still dropping a lot of weight when you go down to 11, and there are a lot of great devices that function there, right? The best devices in the market right now for rescue are really sweet spotted at 11. But that's not always right. You know, a 300-foot 11 is a pack in its own. So then we need to talk about dropping down to smaller rope with lighter equipment. But now we're talking about they're not auto-locking devices. They don't have panic stops. They weren't even really built for rescue. One of the ones out super trendy right now is a little Madrock Safeguard. Certainly not mm-hmm. built. It's a belay device. It is not even a lowering device. It's a belay device. You know, lower 150 feet on that with 9 mil, and you can cook a hot dog on the thing when you're done. But it's putting together different solutions. And until this is a big push for me, is pushing on the manufacturers to say we're headed this direction, right? I was kind of annoyed that, you know, we had this, the believed first, we had the panacea of the MPD, and then now we have the panacea of the clutch, and they're supposed to be the great do everything. And they're good devices for where they are in the market and when they came out and where we are. And then I felt like they went backwards, and they're like, okay, well now for all of you, here's a 12.5 clutch. I was like, no, we had the world moving in the right direction, right? We had them going that way, and you've enabled them to go back the other way. I'd much rather see them start pushing that. I think it's going to skip 10 mil because 10 mil, there isn't enough 10 mil out there being made. I think the next big jump is going to be down towards 9 or maybe 8. And there are some just fantastic 8 mil ropes out there we're using for rescue. But we don't yet have those really easy multi-purpose raise lower devices for that size rope. So we're training with kind of cobbled systems. We have a whole bunch of testing coming to see what's really happening in those. Because we're giving up industry acceptance in safety when we start going to these smaller systems. So.
Absolutely. How is it in the, where you are with the private and government sectors? Like, you're obviously operating under a private sector. You may have some, you know, government contract stuff, but, you know, when it comes to rescues down in the United States, is it primarily government, rescue sector teams, or is it private sector teams? This is something I generally don't know. I don't have an answer for
it. There's a lot of government sector work. But we're not like Europe. Our backcountry rescuers aren't an agency. They aren't a paid team. They aren't necessarily supported by the government, but they're usually, given authority to act under a government agency, right? They don't self-deploy to scenes. They work within the larger system. So there's still generally some kind of a chain of responsibility and command up through a government structure.
Gotcha.
Cool. But a lot of those government agencies will fall back to saying, well, you know, does it fall under NFPA? And NFPA has this great it has a loophole you could drive a Greyhound bus through, which is, the authority having jurisdiction, the AHJ, can make the appropriate decision, right? It falls back to the AHJ deciding what is correct and what is not. And as long as it's not egregiously against standard or against an accepted practice, there's a lot of leeway to work. And that's where the lighter weight stuff is coming in. And the amazing part is you can build some lightweight stuff. You build it right, and you use it in the right operational environment, you can meet some of the NFPA standards that it's not even supposed to apply to. You can get there. Except life safety rope can't be smaller than 10.5 or 11. So you know, it kind of goes out the window there, but you can still get the strength and you can get the operational intent. Does that answer your question? Cool. Long-winded. Sorry.
Yeah, I think so. All good. Is there a certification scheme that you try to conform to when you're training? Are you trying to follow NFPA as much as possible, the AMGA? You know, obviously not IRAD or SPRAD, well, but
it's kind of funny to say obviously
jurisdictions
not.
Jurisdictions there for sure. But.
I'd say obviously yes. more SPRAT than IRADA because it's we're US and there's more SPRAT going on. No, we don't. We have curriculum and courses where the request is train us to NFPA level operations, train us to NFPA level tech. So we have checkboxes to get to in targets, but we're not a certifying body. And actually, there are very few certifying bodies for it.
No, I'm not like, it was just.
We pull from whatever practices we find. And I hate to give him props because I like to pick on him. But like we pull a lot of stuff from the caving world. There's just some really amazing ingenuity that goes on underground. And we pull, you know, some stuff comes out of the guiding world a little bit less. Because guiding is really geared towards one man, one riot solutions, right? You're alone. You've got three clients. This is what you have. How are you going to solve it? And that's not really our client. We don't train the guides. We train rescuers who tend to show up at least with a small team approach. So we're gonna have a little bit different systems because we have the ability to involve a few more people. But I mean, you have to know the standards and you have to know we're going to mix them together. We're going to mix the influences. All right. I just ordered a whole new set of NFPA books that I can read over the holidays so I can read the new standards. Yay. I know how to have fun.
Yay. Yeah. I just seen that.
That's
new
what
10-06
I ordered 1006 and then I ordered paper copies of the others because I guess I'm old and I just like to work with paper copy instead of PDF.
I'm a fan of the paper copy. You can highlight it.
And I think the more I do this, coming out of the backcountry rescue world, I was pretty down on NFPA. We joked about it. Like the NFPA monkey showed up with their big trucks and their big stuff. Understanding that it's written with kind of a lot of grace and leeway now. There's some great stuff in those documents and I need to be more fluent in them. That's the goal.
Cool. All right. So the next highlighted topic we wanted to chat about here is the push from the large industry into your case, the small industry. First off, I would like to say there are two totally different industries here. Obviously, understanding each industry independently, you must follow the directives for those guidelines or for those industries. So, you know, you're following guidelines from, you know, like you said, the caving industry, the NFPA industry, you know, probably adopting stuff from the AMGA. And then obviously, you know, you kind of touched on it, but, you know, adopting some things from the SPRAD industry. Those are all different industries, but collectively for what you do, they come together and work, you know, seamlessly on a way that you've found works for you. So let's dive into this a little bit here. All right. So we have IRADA and SPRAD pushing this double protection. And we're really talking about the double protection for rigging plates and pulleys and equipment. You know, we talked about it already about, you know, in training, you do a double rope system instead of a single rope system. How does this differ in your industry? Why is this a disadvantage for what you do and how you are trying to educate the the people that come to you to learn?
So at the start, I think there's a lot of good to it. Having people think right off the bat, kind of as a fundamental principle, that we shouldn't have single points of failure is a pretty good starting position in rescue, right? Let's think about that. I think it's more important that people can work through a system and identify what those points of failure are or aren't, right? I was in a course and I was participating and I had to just clear a locked ASAP, right? They said, descend till your ASAP locks, clear the problem, move on with your life. And I descended, my ASAP locked, and I reached up and I realized I could get just above it with my hand. So I locked off my descender. I reached up, I put a TIB lock and a non-locking roll clip above the ASAP, grabbed my rope tail and my primary, slapped it through the non-locking gate, pulled tension, released the ASAP, took my gear off and kept moving. And I got to the bottom and it wasn't the assessor, the instructor was like, what was that? Like, can you
greatest skill of all time.
Can you do that? And the funny thing is it wasn't about kind of like the lateral thought of I'm just going to grab tension. It was that the gate wasn't locking on the roll clip. That was the issue, because it's a non-locking gate and it had no backup. The problem to that thought process is the next step wasn't what's the consequence. The consequence was nil, right? If that carabiner spontaneously evaporated, nothing unsafe was going to happen. No change was really going to come to the system. So
nope.
I like the thought of let's really think about making sure we don't have single points of failure, but we need to have the next discussion, which is what is the consequence of those failures? And make decisions based on consequence. You're a mountain guy, right? So you've been through your avalanche training.
Yep.
I draw this parallel. Yeah, yeah. This is the parallel I draw all the time. That in the avalanche world,
okay,
we base our decisions really on two things. What's the likelihood of something happening, and what's the consequence if it does? And I'd love to have that thought process come more into the rope rescue world, rather than just let's make everything double redundant.
The game of probability of consequences is extremely valuable in everything that we do in life.
Yes. Try teaching that to a 4-year-old. Thanks.
Good luck. Have fun with that one.
And I'm giving him a baseball bat for Christmas.
If you jump off your bed and smack your head, what's the consequence?
So I think there's good push. I think Rope Access is putting a really good push into the rescue world to bring in newer practices. But we can't just accept them as new dogma, right? The old dogma has problems. Let's not just absorb newer dogma because it's new. Let's think about it logically and decide, are these good things to bring in? Are they necessary? And be more thoughtful about it.
Are you talking about like common sense here? Because common sense isn't
it's interesting.
Very common.
So when I was my last year in high school, I completely destroyed my elbow. I folded it backwards, had all sorts of surgery. I was in a sling for months, 2 years of rehab. And my first doctor's appointment after my surgery, my surgeon hands me 2 pennies. And I'm like, what are you doing? He said, these are common sense. I know you have none. Please carry this with you. Right.
That's brilliant.
So I don't think relying on common sense is necessarily a good plan. But you know, I use the term data, not dogma, all the time. Let's think about real numbers and real probabilities, not just throw dogma at it. And I think that's where you get, you end up with this position. If you don't do that, that's where you end up with the position of double your rigging plates. Right. Because two is one mentality. So you must have two because it's safer. No, it's not. Look at it analytically, look at it logically and understand that it's actually a bad redundancy decision. This is where it comes into kind of the mountain rescue world. So I'll actually start to answer your question for you. Especially when you go lightweight, you're not just going light with gear. You're generally going light with personnel. You have fewer people to solve the problem. So every decision you make about making your system more complex or more redundant comes with a resource cost. And if that resource cost is people, and adding a second system behind it takes away people. You need to do another task. You need to look at the whole picture and say, what's the safest overall approach with the resources I have? And it may not be more redundancy. It may not be adding more people. It may be making different decisions. I kind of joke about it a little bit. This whole thing about having a tailor on your ropes, right? You have one person running two devices, or you have one person running one device. And because that person could screw up, you're going to put a person behind them holding the rope. If you have limited people, having a person just hold rope may be a horrible allocation of resources. And if you've already made the decision that you're okay running a system in an austere environment on lightweight gear, the lightweight rope, maybe it's okay to make the assumption that your people are skilled enough. You don't have to back up your people. You need to back up your systems, or back up your systems where the consequence of failure is significant. If the consequence isn't, don't worry about it. Right? This is, you know,
yep.
double pulleys on a minor deviation. Fine. What's the consequence of a 10 degree deviation failing? Maybe not that great. A 70 degree deviation that fails, you got a big problem, right? Look at the consequence of the failure, not just could it fail.
Yeah,
I don't think I answered your question, but I had fun.
Yeah, I think you really kind of talked about the disadvantage there. Like for you, it's a resource problem. In a lot of cases, either equipment resources or personnel resources. It's a massive disadvantage for you.
And I think something we need to recognize, especially when we're talking about mountain stuff and deep wilderness stuff.
Yeah.
And I had a rescue I did with a really good friend of mine several years ago. They've been looking for a guy who'd climbed South Sister in Oregon the 2 days before. And he'd done it in running shoes and running shorts. It was an up and down, and he didn't come back. And we got tasked to go back up the team that had been looking for him the entire first day and couldn't find him. So we're light packs. We get flown in, thank God. And it's two of us with super light, only the gear we have, you know, normally in our personal kits. And we find the guy about 200 feet down a snow and scree slope off the wrong side of the mountain. And he's so hypothermic, he can barely walk. And we brought him back up and kind of an assist, you know, kind of a belayed push, right? Rescuer went behind him. He was roped up, all single rope, because it's the rope we had. And you bring the guy up, because what we need to recognize the situation, he's dead if you don't. And that needs to be part of the decision-making process. What's the consequence of waiting for more people and more rope in that situation? Can you do it safe enough to get the job done, knowing what your resources and your consequences are at the time? And you'll make a different decision, right? If I'm climbing with my best friend, and he's geckoed out on a ledge, I guarantee you, I will make different decisions to rescue that person than I would if it were a stranger. We have to recognize those things in our thought processes. They're real. They're part of the decision.
Yeah. Yeah. When you're making those decisions, that probability consequence comes
into
play.
And what's my long-term consequence if I watch my best friend fall to their death when I think I could have helped them? Yeah.
Yeah, that sucks.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, that's all I have for today. Is there anything you want to add?
The usual. Thank you. This is fun stuff. I'm sure we will say things that people agree with or don't agree with. And I think some of these are about not necessarily about saying who's right or who's wrong, but forwarding good discussion and forwarding good conversation. And if that can be done respectfully, even if we're wrong about stuff, and I'm sure I'm wrong about stuff.
Heck, me too.
But if we can get other smart people engaged in the conversation, we're all better for it, right? We all know we're doing stuff today that 10 years from now, we'll look back and think that was super dumb and super unsafe, but we haven't figured it out yet. So keep talking about it, keep trying to figure it out, and as an industry, get better. So.
Yeah. As an industry, keep working together, keep getting, cross certifications and working on your professional development and trying new techniques. It will only better you at the end of the day and better the industry.
So in the end, this is super fun, but come to classes, right? This is part of why we do this. So I know that's next on your list. You can find us on Instagram at the Cracker Jack Group. Group is GRP, not GROUP. Facebook, our website, crackerjackgroup.com. You can call me 503-519-4312. That's the business number. That's my number. If you have questions about courses, something we can do to help, come play with us. It's fun and it's our life.
Yeah. Well, when this border decides to open up and our world doesn't, hate itself any longer, I'm definitely coming down to
awesome.
Play around. That would be amazing to come down there. I've never been to Colorado, so that would be a fun experience in itself. I would really like to play around with your systems and what you do and learn from you. So thank you very much for taking the time to indulge me in this conversation, and I hope that the followers and listeners definitely
and have fun editing out all our gibberish.
It's been a pleasure. Yeah. the best part. All right, well, thank you very much again. Cheers. All right, well, thank you very much for tuning into today's episode. That was a super fun episode to record. He's definitely that guy that once you get on the line, I hope you have some time, because the conversation just keeps going and going and going. Nonetheless, great conversation, had some great laughs. So if you like this episode, please make sure to like this episode on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast. If you have the ability, comment down below. Let me know what you thought about it. Subscribe to the channel if you haven't, and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time.